Thank you. Thank you so much. The mics are on.
Okay, and this one's on.
And this one is on.
And this one, perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it is such an honor for me to be here and to have the opportunity to speak with you. And before I begin, I want to thank John McKay. I want to thank David Anderson. I want to thank David Quest and the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada for hosting this talk. And I want to point out that this is a talk that has bipartisan support. We have one MP from the Liberal Party, one MP from the Conservative Party, and that is important to note because we're talking about a topic of the utmost significance. We are talking about the future of our children and grandchildren. What kind of future are they going to inherit? Now, the topic, the title of my talk, I did not title it loosely. It's Canadian Marriage Policy, A Tragedy for Children. Now, tragedy is a strong term. And I mean it in both the commonsensical notion of tragedy, that it is a policy that hurts children, as well as evoking the Greek tragedy sense of the term. In Greek tragedy, what you have superior men and women. You have the very best who have to make a decision. And they make a decision in which they manifest hubris. Hubris is a kind of arrogance, thinking that they know best. And in making that decision, they do not take account of the human condition, the limitations of the human condition. They make a decision that has tragic consequences. And they come to know that they've made a decision that is irrevocable. Irrevocable harm has been done. Now, of course, Canadians, to some extent, through their judiciary and their elected figures, the elites, the best and the brightest, are recreating something of a tragedy, a Greek tragedy, in the Canadian context. They have made a choice. They have made a choice to favor companionate marriage over child-centered marriage. Now, to understand what these terms are, first of all, let's talk about marriage. I know that this is the term itself has been debated, so I'm going to give you the broadest possible definition in which I'm going to then characterize the two sides of the debate. Marriage is simply a social institution. As a social institution, it is composed of a set of norms. Norms are simply expectations for how people are to act, that we internalize, we become role players, and most of the time we act according to these. So something can be a norm in the empirical sense, which says that most of the time this happens, but the more deep and fundamental sense of that which is normative is that you expect certain conduct, certain behavior of people. The two senses of that which is normative come together. Well, we have two paradigms of what marriage as a social institution ought to be, is and ought to be. The traditional, child-centered understanding of marriage in terms of its normative structure is not rocket science. You all know what it is or used to be. They're very simple norms. It is, number one, you shouldn't have sex outside of marriage. You shouldn't have sex before you marry. You shouldn't have sex with somebody else while you are within the institution of marriage. Number two, marriage is between a man and a woman. They're allowed to have sex with each other. Indeed, we want to channel human sexuality into the institution of marriage. That's the proper place for it to take place. Number three, if through their sexual relations, if they should conceive and bear a child, they are the parents of that child. They are mother and father. And as mother and father, they have a responsibility to rear that child, to care for it, to educate it. And number four, this is a long-term commitment. It's a long-term commitment because raising children is a lifetime's work. Okay, that's in a nutshell what the child-centered view of marriage is. The other paradigm, which is gaining increasing currency in the Canadian context, is what I call the companionate view of marriage. And I didn't create that term. It's a term that started being used in the 1920s to describe a shift in the institution of marriage, of which I will have a little bit more to say. But this view holds, insofar as marriage has a normative structure, is that we have adults who choose to be together for their mutual betterment, and that this is something that should be recognized publicly. So insofar as it has a normative structure, it is based on choice and desire, that we want to be together, we want to have this publicly recognized. Okay, how is it that in Canadian society and in the American context at large, how is it that we have moved from one paradigm of marriage, a child-centered paradigm, to a companionate view of marriage? Well, quite frankly, in a larger historical sense, it has everything to do with the Industrial Revolution. Why, you might ask? Well, it was the Industrial Revolution that provided societies with significant resources. Resources so that women could stay home, because in agrarian societies, women worked on farms with their husbands. It's only with the rise of mature industrial societies that we have women who are able to stay home, and they have more leisure time than they've ever had before. It is also this which has allowed us, technology, to sever sex from procreation. Now, the history of this, by the early 20th century, we have industrial societies that are fairly mature at this point. The 1920s, it's also a time of prosperity. Usually you need to have a certain sense of prosperity. You can't feel like your existence is being threatened for this to be to happen. The companionate view of marriage then became prevalent in America as the role of women started to be redefined. You've all heard of flappers, the liberation of women, that they were to no longer be determined by biology, This is where we have Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood that's become founded. And that the role of a woman is primarily to be the companion of her husband. So this is the origins of it. The companionate view of marriage needed not just a mature industrial society to happen. It also, in this case, has the development of an ideology by elites. Recall that idea of hubris. An ideology in which elites understand, they have the unique right understanding of liberty and equality. It just so happens that these understandings also serve to empower the state, of which the elites are going to be the determinative members. And we have, it first manifests itself as a progressive movement in the 1920s. By the 1960s, it is then manifested in what is more typically called the liberal ideology. We see this, I mean, it's not a surprise that the movements to start challenging the norms of marriage happen again in the 1960s, because at this point in time, we have about 15 years of prosperity. After the end of the Second World War, we have American Canadian societies feeling pretty comfortable again. We have an excess of wealth production. We also, during this time, have baby boomers who, when you get youth populations, large youth populations, it tends to be number one, very creative, and number two, fairly destabilizing to a population. This is something that resonates. And we begin to see the dismantling of the norms that constitute marriage. The first of these in the Canadian context is with the introduction of no-fault or unilateral divorce in 1968. This is a challenge to one of the central norms of marriage, that marriage is supposed to be for a very long period of time. We hope it's going to be for a lifetime. Now, at the time that this was passed into law, it was thought to be a humanitarian measure that would apply to a very small proportion of the population. It would simply make it easier for a handful of very unhappy people to divorce. And of course, that was going to be in the best interest of the children, because if mom and dad are very unhappy, of course, it's terrible for the children. Well, we know now it takes about a generation to get hard data, the longitudinal data of how people actually do when they're raised in these circumstances. We know now that all of the assumptions that were made about divorce law at that time are not true. Divorce did not affect just a small percentage of the population. The divorce rate has grown to approximately about 40% of all marriages now end in divorce. Moreover, it turns out that divorce generally isn't in the best interest of children. We have now, and this is data that had been hotly contested for ideological reasons for a long time, but now there's uncontrovertible social scientific evidence that children of divorce, regardless of their socioeconomic status, tend to be far more depressed, more tendencies towards suicide. Males demonstrate more antisocial behavior, more apt to get involved with the criminal justice system. Females are more apt to have teen pregnancies or births out of wedlock, which then perpetrates a cycle of poverty. Because one of the biggest contributors to poverty is teen pregnancy. If you don't have a married couple with at least a high school education, that's a recipe for a cycle of poverty. Okay, so that was the first norm that was challenged.